been a long time.
Too long,
I know. It has. But first, I have to remember, everybody's away. Now, they told me, a few people have told me they're not coming. Sylvia, Riva, I don't know, Mrs. Amsler. Anyways, a bunch of people away. All right, it's just us. It's also good. After the school holidays, that's right. We need a break from the break. Yes, okay. Well, we are going to start the new Parsha, Parshas Matis. Now, it was interesting because as we went through the Chumash, we went through so many fascinating stories, and stories are always more interesting, but the Chumash is not just made up of stories, it's actually mainly teaching us how to live our life. So in Parshas Matis and then Masa, which is usually read together, we're coming to the end of Chumash Bamidbar, which signifies, in a way, the end of the journey of the Jewish people in the desert. And that's why over here in these last ending Parshas, we have a lot of different things which apply to the Jewish people when they're going to be entering in the land of Israel. And it's more halachas to do with the future, in a sense, and for eternity, not just for the time they're in the desert. The first part of Parshas Matis deals with a section of halacha, which I am definitely no expert in, and will not go into it in too much depth, the exact details, but we're going to see some beautiful lessons even just about it. And it is about the concept of, in Hebrew we call them, a general term would be nidarim. Nidarim are vows, promises that we make. So the interesting thing is that when a person thinks of a vow or a promise, what comes to mind first? I don't know, I make a promise, I'll do something, or I'll make a promise, you know, that's usually, and then we have to keep it, or sometimes we make promises that we'll donate a certain amount of money or a certain amount of time, or we'll do a certain mitzvah. But in a certain way over here, we're talking more about, and it's interesting, there's a difference between what we call a neder and a shvuah. A neder, which is which we translate them both like a promise, an oath, is when a person says about a certain object, I'm going to stay away from that, whatever, a certain type of food. And we're talking not about something that we're not permitted to have. We're talking about in the realm of what's permissible, right? So we're not talking about something that's not kosher. We're talking about something that is kosher. And we say, I'm not going to engage with that item. That's a neder. Whereas a promise is more something like, I won't go to sleep until this time of the night, or I won't, whatever it may be. So it's more something that you take upon yourself, not with another object. Okay, it's just a technical difference. But our parasha, as we're going to see now, is very interesting, because even though I just said, this is really where we find the laws of promises in the Torah, the truth is that what it deals with more is not the making of the promise and the keeping of the promise, rather how to annul the promise. That's it's actually quite funny in a way, because you would think, it's not funny, it sounds a bit strange, that if we're talking about halachas to do with making and keeping promises, you would have more about that. Annulling is like, oh my gosh, like that's like the last resort. If you can't, you know, you made the promise and now you can't keep it, what can we do about it? But interestingly, that's the main focus of the psukim that we're going to do. And we're going to see, it's actually amazing lessons that come through. Just to start, a drop to give us a little bit of food for thought. What would we think is the main emphasis of a lesson to do with making a promise? What would that, so to speak, if you want to broaden it a little bit, what would that be covering? Which topic? Which thing that we engage in a lot? Which one of our capacities as human beings? What's one of the biggest capacity that we were given that distinguishes us as a human from everything else? Yeah, exactly. Speech, exactly. Our ability to speak. And speech is something which is such a fascinating thing because, I mean, thank God most of us, I mean, unless there's a problem, learn to speak somewhere within the first 3 years of our life, right? Where some babies speak earlier, some speak a little bit later, but by the time we're three, most people can communicate on some level or another. Right? That's the normal thing. And we take it for granted afterwards that we will be able to say what we want, what we're feeling, what we need, we're able to talk to somebody, right? We almost do take it for granted. And yet when we think about speech is one of the biggest gifts that Hashem has given to man. First of all, it allows us to be connected, right? It connects. That's how we connect to others. It's the biggest tool. You know, I'm sorry. I just want to silence. I forgot to. Let me just find out how to do it on this thing now. It's harder once I've shared the screen. I'm so sorry. I keep hearing noises. I don't know. Anyways, I hope they won't disturb because I can't figure out why it's not coming. Anyway. Me and my computer. Computers also help us communicate, but anyways, I know, me too. So speech is such a gift. And we know, interesting thing it says about human beings, that when Hashem created the human being, right, it says initially, he put in the neshama, right? He blew the neshama into us. But one of the words that's used right away, it says that Hashem gave us ruach memalala, which is translated as the capacity to speak. That's really what distinguishes us as human beings. And I remember, I know I've shared this a lot of times. Funny, when I was a child, you know, one of the heroes, you know, that I still think she is a hero, is Helen Keller. You know, she was an American, right? And she was deaf, she was blind. And I remember once reading about what she said, fascinating thing that she said. She said if she was able, I mean, obviously this is her speaking with a lack of both capacities, but still, if she was able to ask for one, hearing or seeing, which one would she ask for? And she said that she thinks that hearing is the bigger thing. Why? Because she said the world is a world of communication. And that's how we connect to each other. And it's a very fascinating thing, because I always think, like, you know, when you see, you're able to be independent, whereas when you can't see, it takes away a lot of the independence. And yet, the truth is that as a human being, what is one of our greatest needs? Our greatest needs is to have a connection to another. And we know that's what makes us psychologically healthy, is when we have that ability, and not only the ability, but we actually have connection to each other. So speech is such a powerful, such an incredibly important part of ourselves. And therefore, what comes through here, we're going to see, is that a person has to always realize that, sorry, at the same time that it's such a powerful tool, it's so, how do you say it? It's so automatic. Like we said, we learn it as a child. Because of that, unfortunately, many times, we tend to misuse it. But it's not only misuse. So misuse, okay, we know, we're aware, but we also tend to underrate it. And we just don't treat it with the respect that it deserves, almost. Like, in a sense, like, we take it for granted, you know? Wake up, we can speak. Of course we can speak. Well, anybody can speak. And we don't put that, like, incredible respect that it deserves. And therefore, because of that, we don't measure our words, we don't think before we speak, we don't think after we speak, and we just use it almost like the most used thing that we have, in a sense, and the most like easy thing, and like with such a negligence and such a lack of respect. And this is what the Mefarshim tell us, that this chapter in the Chumash actually is really here to teach us, and we'll see as we learn it more and more why it comes through, the value that we have to place, the importance and the respect and the, like, you know, the treasure of what speech is. And therefore, obviously, because it's such a treasure, how to use it in the most proper way possible. So let's see a little bit of the more details in the Chumash. And another little side thing that I always say, you know, we learn Chumash, each one of us comes with our own preconceived, not only but our own pre-existing, you know, whatever it may be, our experiences. And in today's day and age, this specific chapter wouldn't be considered so politically correct. Why? Because this chapter in Chumash, as I said, has to do with annulling vows. And it specifically talks about if a person takes a vow upon themselves, so if it's a girl of a certain age, then her father can annul her vows, and we'll see a little bit. And if it's a woman who's married, sometimes her husband can override her vows, which we know nowadays would not go down very well. But let's just see how the halacha is and understand a little bit. Like I said, I'm not teaching halacha, so it won't go so much detail, but just to see more the meaning and what it really means for all of us. Okay, so just a few small things before we go into the Chumash, because just to give a drop of background, and then we're going to see some of the psukim and some of the beautiful lessons. So obviously, as we see, a person should never take an oath or a vow lightly. even though sometimes we do. And also what people don't realize, when we say an oath or a vow, you don't have to say, "I promise," for it to be considered a vow. If somebody says, "I am going to do such and such," and they mean it, right? They're going to do, even if they didn't say, "I promise," it's considered a promise. And you have to keep your word. Sometimes people don't realize that. So it's an interesting thing. So like if somebody says, I'm not going to drink wine for a month, whatever it may be, then you have to be really careful and not drink that wine for the month. Because once you've said that, that's considered a promise, an oath, that's considered. And if you want to drink wine in that month, you have to go through a procedure of annulling that, even though you didn't say, "I promise." So it's just one important thing. Okay, so then just a small little introductory thing. It's as the commentaries tell us, why would a person take upon themselves this kind of an oath? Why would you want to stay away from something? You know, it's a fascinating thing that it says that the Mefarshim actually talk about that Hashem has given us so many mitzvahs. And we know that there's so many things that we shouldn't be doing. We try, everybody tries on their own level. But there's so many things that we're not allowed to engage in. Like, for example, there's lots of food that we're not supposed to eat. There's certain activities that we're not supposed to do on certain days, right? There's so many things that are, if you want to say, forbidden to us, right? We say a person, whatever, we don't have to go into detail. We know there's so many. So the Gemara makes an interesting comment. It says, Hashem has given us so many things that we're forbidden from doing. Why would somebody willingly take upon themselves even more? It's enough what the Torah says you're not allowed to do. Why would you want to take upon yourself to do even, like not to do even more things? And almost laughs at the person and mocks the person and says that this is a mistake. And not only is it a mistake in that way, but also because we say we were put into this world, and Hashem, it says actually that after 120, Hashem will say, "Why didn't you enjoy my world?" Like if a person says, "I'm not going to eat, I don't know, a mango," whatever, right? So Hashem will say, "Why didn't you enjoy my delicious mangoes? I made them in this world for you to enjoy." So in other words, Hashem gave us the pleasures and the nice things and the beautiful things in this world, and they're meant for us to enjoy. That's the purpose. So that we should have a good, like Hashem wants us to live a good life, so to speak, as much as possible. So in other words, what it means sounds like, it's discouraging us from taking upon ourselves things that we shouldn't do when we have enough things that we shouldn't do. So why would a person, yes, do it? So the Gemara goes through and the Chachamim discuss, if you want to say, three scenarios maybe, what might motivate a person. So he says, like sometimes a person perhaps, we understand it now in psychology, there's different approaches to addiction. But if somebody becomes addicted to something, so sometimes the best way is to actually stay away totally, right? Somebody gambles, you say, don't go near anywhere that's gambling, right? Because you can't engage in it in a healthy way. You have to stay away, right? So there's all kinds of different things that a person might feel that realm they don't have control. So that sometimes the best way is, I stay away from it totally. And that's where a person might engage in making this kind of a vow, because they know that even though it's permitted to other people, when it comes to them, they find it a little bit more difficult to control themselves. People do that sometimes with food, right? If they feel that there's certain kinds of foods that triggers them, they say, and then they won't be able to stop eating. They say, okay, I won't eat this so that this way I'll be able to be in control. Even though for other people, it's fine if they eat that because they know when to stop. That's one time. Another thing is interesting that a person might, sometimes if a mitzvah comes up in somebody's hands, and like an example, even nowadays you find it, like for example, I don't know, somebody tells you about a certain kind of tzedakah, and not necessarily with money, but even with time, you know, you say, if I don't commit, I won't do it. You know, like if I don't tell somebody, meet me this and this time, and we'll go volunteer and do this and this, well, then you might want all you want, but you'll stay. You'll have other things will drag you away, and you won't do it. So sometimes a person might promise in order to make sure that they actually get to do something. That's another motivation. And then there's a fascinating thing that we find. This we find in the stories of the Chumash, that it's historically that sometimes people took upon themselves vows when they were in a time of difficulty. Like we find with Yaakov Avinu, you know, when he was facing Esav and he was petrified, or even before he went into Lavan, and he was so afraid of the danger that he was going to face, so he made a vow. He says, if I come out safely, then I'll give a certain sacrifice, or I'll, you know, learn a certain amount of Torah, whatever it may be. And this is considered, it's okay to do that. It gives a person a certain strength to hold on to. It's like, it's almost like you're holding on to that and you're saying, I'm going to make it through and I'll be able to do this. But it's also, in a sense, almost like asking Hashem to help us in the merit of that which we are promising. So these are different motivations that might make a person, motivate a person to take on certain vows and certain oaths. Okay, now we all know that at the same time, we have to be very careful and not just do it like, you know, like so to speak, not give it, like say, oh, like I'm in the mood today. You know what, I'm so motivated, or I'm so inspired. You know, you go to a speech, like nowadays, unfortunately, I mean, there was so, now you listen, it's so hard to listen, but you listen to all the people who came out of the, you know, the hostages, and you listen to all the, and you do, you get inspired, and it's good to get inspired. I mean, that's what we should do. Get inspired, and you feel down at the same time. Everything, the whole emotions are all mixed. It's crazy. It's terrible. But sometimes you get really motivated to do something. But a person has to be careful when they're making, giving their word, that they're actually able to follow through. So it is good sometimes to, yes, commit, obviously, because we want to grow and do more things. But we have to always measure and be very, very careful. And actually, the Chachamim use very strong language for people who are easy to make promises and don't think before they talk. And there's a lot of negative things said about them, and actually negative consequences, quite harsh consequences, that is told. I'll just give one example, and then I'm going to go into more details of these. So one example that's given, this is an actual real story, and it's a harsh story. I think now we have so much harshness that I don't know, but anyways, we don't need harsh stories, but still, it just brings it home so strongly. At the time of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, so just before the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, it was destroyed by the Babylonians. They were taking over slowly. They were, especially the king Nebuchadnezzar, he was, you know, becoming more and more the ruler over the land of Israel. There were still kings in the land of Israel, Jewish kings, but we know that they were really, they didn't have much power. The Babylonians had the power. So one of the last kings in the times of the Jewish people, was his name was Tzidkiyahu. He was one of the last ones. And the story goes that Tzidkiyahu went to wherever the king Nebuchadnezzar was, to his palace, in order to do the politically correct thing and bring some presents and to try to appease the king so that he should treat the people in Israel nicely. I mean, this is all throughout history. We've always had this. So that's what he did. That wasn't a bad thing. He went. He was apparently given respect. Nebuchadnezzar saw that Tzidkiyahu is a special person, respected him. Anyways, he was brought into his palace. Apparently, one of the, like, he was there for a few days. One of the times he walked in on the king without Nebuchadnezzar realizing. And what was Nebuchadnezzar doing? It's a crazy thing to think, but he was actually tearing off the limbs of a rabbit that was alive and eating it. He was a very cruel king. Unfortunately, the cruelty doesn't start now, so it started all the way then. And this is how he was treating an animal, so you can imagine. And he treated people the same way. But anyways, so now, Tzidkiyahu saw this. Nebuchadnezzar was devastated that he had been exposed, that he was doing such terrible things. So he was petrified that Tzidkiyahu would tell other people. Obviously, in those days, there's no WhatsApps, but communication was still there, and word would get out. So what did he do? He made Tzidkiyahu promise. He said, promise me that you will tell nobody what you saw. That's what Nebuchadnezzar said. And Tzidkiyahu had no choice, and he promised. When he got back to the land of Israel, he felt like, why should I have given that promise? That was a mistake. I don't want to give that promise. Maybe Nebuchadnezzar should be exposed for what he is. Why should I have to keep my word? And therefore, he went down the road of what we're going to see today, that there is a concept that a person is allowed to annul their vows. There's different ways of doing it. Either you go to one expert, or the better way is to go to a Beis Din. You just like need three, even three ordinary people, but definitely in front of the Sanhedrin. You can go in front of the Sanhedrin and you can tell the Sanhedrin that at the time that you made that vow, you didn't really want to make it. So retroactively, they annul it. They say you didn't really do the vow properly when you were doing it, and therefore you are not bound by it. And the Sanhedrin agreed, and he wasn't bound. And after the whole story, how somebody was talking about Nebuchadnezzar, and it came out, he said it, Tzidkiyahu said it, the word got back to Nebuchadnezzar. He heard what Tzidkiyahu had said, and he was so angry because he said he made a promise that he's not going to tell anybody, and he broke his promise. So he calls Nebuchadnezzar, he calls Tzidkiyahu in, and he's like trying to figure out how is it that he was able to break his promise. And he asks him, it's very interesting, he's a smart man, to tell him to start teaching him all the laws of the Torah. And he goes through the parshiyos of the Torah until he comes to this parsha. And when he hears this concept that a person has the ability to annul a vow, and how do you do it? You go in front of a court of law. So Nebuchadnezzar realized, that must be what Tzidkiyahu did. So what did he do? He didn't just take revenge on Tzidkiyahu. It says, we won't discuss, describe exactly how. We unfortunately have experienced many tortures. But he took the members of the Sanhedrin and he tortured them to death. He did. All because, why? So the Chachamim say, he didn't do anything technically wrong, Tzidkiyahu. But he wasn't careful with his words to begin with, and then he wasn't careful with his words afterwards. Because he should have, if he said it, too bad. Now he should have kept it. Just showing us again the power, so to speak, of what the consequences of what we say and how it can affect so many people. So that's just one historical story that we have. But just to put it on, but just one more thing before we go inside, let's see if there was another important thing, as I said, this parasha talks more about the annulment. Let's look in your pages. I just want to read a few of the psukim, and then we'll see again some beautiful lessons. So I'll start. It's on page 370. You can see the psukim here. So it says, "Vayidaber Moshe el Roshei Hamates." Moshe spoke to the heads of the tribes. So go to the next page, and we'll come back to the Rashi. Livnei Yisrael, to the children of Israel, Lamar saying, Ze hadavar, this is the matter, Asher tziva Hashem, that Hashem has commanded. Now, before we go back, I just want to highlight one thing that we're going to discuss. Who is Moshe Rabbeinu speaking to here? This is quite unusual. If you look at the first pasuk, what did we read? Who is he speaking to? Vayidaber Moshe?
The tribes.
The heads of the tribes. Okay. So does he speak just to the heads, or does he speak to the entire Jewish people?
I think he speaks to the heads.
Do you think he speaks to the heads? You're definitely, there are many commentaries that agree with you, Rona, 100%. That's what it seems. So speaking to the heads. And maybe what we might assume is that the heads will teach it to the rest of the Jewish world. Right? We might assume that this specific chapter was said only to the heads. Okay, we're going to see what Rashi thinks, and we'll see what the other commentaries. I just want to go further and see something else interesting. And then also fascinating thing is what doesn't say here, this is obviously a group of laws that Moshe Rabbeinu was teaching to the Jewish people. But Moshe had to have been commanded by Hashem initially, right? It doesn't say that here. Usually it says, like, Hashem speaks to Moshe, and then Moshe speaks to the Jewish people. Here it doesn't say that. It's actually interesting. So we'll see, because it says it all the way at the end. Okay, so let's see what he says. What's the thing that Moshe says to these leaders? So it says in Pasuk Gimel, Ish ki yidar neder l'Hashem, if a man takes a vow to Hashem, oy hi shava shvuah, as we said, there's a slight difference between a vow or an oath, but they have the same severity. So if you take a vow or if you take an oath, and what is it? L'esar isar, to prohibit. A prohibition, as he says, in other words, to say, I'm not allowed to do this and this, I'm not going to eat this, I'm not going to, you know, engage in this activity, whatever it may be, al nafshay, upon his soul. So very, very, the three very powerful words here are loy yachel dvarai. He shall not profane his words. Like from the words choyl, you know, like we say Shabbos and choyl. Shabbos is holiness. Chayil is considered weekday, or something which is less holy, not sanctified. But over here it's even stronger, like Chilul Hashem. Lo yachel dvarai. Do not profane your words, which means do not cheapen your words. Do not just treat them as if you can just say whatever you like and then do whatever you like. It doesn't work like that. As he says, K'chol hayotzei mipiv, yase. Everything that comes out of your mouth, you should do. Now, that's one pasuk, right, as we can see. And this is the only pasuk that deals with the laws, specifically of Nedarim, which is not very much at all, because there's sections and sections in the Mishnah and the Gemara to give us all the different technicalities. How does it work? What does a person have to say? You know, what is, all the different things of what it involves. What is yes considered an oath? What is not considered an oath? And yet this is it. Now let's see what he takes, a little diversion. Let's see what he does. Stress more. V'isha. So now if a woman, kisidar neder l'Hashem, if she takes upon herself a vow. I lost everything. People are back, but I'm back. And this is a computer. Okay, let's see. He says, if a woman will take a vow to Hashem or prohibit a prohibition in her father's house, as he says, in her youth. So this is a very specific thing. This is talking about a girl, and it's a very hard thing to understand what age we're talking about. She has to be at least 11 years old, because before that her words don't... A child, you can't hold them to their word. But she can't be over the age of like 12 and a half, because then she's not under her father's jurisdiction. So it's a very sort of like a small age gap.
Not until she's married.
Oh, so we'll see in a minute about married. But if let's say she's not married and she's 13, then her father has no jurisdiction over her. Okay, then she's her own free woman. Then whatever she says, she has to keep, or whatever she doesn't say. Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting, Sheila. We'll see in a minute, because there is also to do with marriage. Let's see, he says. But first he goes through with the father. He says, Vishama avia esnidra, and her father heard of her vow, the esara, and her prohibition, asher asra, right, that she... Asra al-Nafsha, that she took upon herself, that she forbid herself. The Hecherishla, and her father was silent. In a minute, I'll tell you what that means. The Kamu Kol Nidareha, then all her vows shall stand. The Chol Isar Asher Asra al-Nafsha Yakum, all her vows and all her any prohibition that she prohibited upon herself shall stand. So, in other words, if she says, I don't know, whatever, I'm not going to sleep before 10 p.m. every night for the next month. Let's say she says that. And her father hears her. And he says nothing. That day that she said it, that's it. She can keep, it's a promise that's hers. And she has to keep her promise, first of all. And not only does she have to keep her promise, but her father can do nothing about it the next day. He has only 20, we'll see in a minute. If, he says, im heini avia isa. But if her father restrained her, which means he blocked her, he says, no, I'm not letting you take this promise. When can he do that? B'yayim shamay, on the day he heard, kol nidareha v'esareha, asher asra al-nafsha, all the promises, all the things that she took upon herself that she's not going to do. Lo yakum, then we say, she doesn't keep it. V'Hashem yislach la, and Hashem will forgive her. Because you might think, oh my gosh, she took a promise. Now her father's overriding her promise. Maybe she's going to be held responsible. So no, she's not held responsible because her father overrid her promise. Now, I just want to, again, I'm not going to go too much detail, even though I know it's a big question for us how this works. Why should her father even have any jurisdiction over her? First, like I say, it's a very small, it's like a very short amount of interval of time. It says because at that time the father is still responsible for her. He's considered responsible, and to the extent that he has to provide everything for her at that age, at that stage in life. And because he's responsible, so we say, when will a father override a promise? And I'll give you a better example. Let's say a girl says, I am not going to sleep before 1 a.m. every night. It's not going to be healthy for her. So if it's something that's going to damage her, that's what it says, then it's much better for the father to override it, because he knows it's not healthy for her to do that. And therefore he says, no, I don't let you make this promise. And the promise automatically is annulled. Okay? The other promises that we said before that a normal person takes upon themselves, I'd said man, but it means also woman, an adult woman. If she takes upon herself a promise, it's just a normal promise. I'm going to do such and such. I'm going to help such and such a person, right? It's not a dangerous promise. If a person wants to annul that promise, that's more difficult in a way. Because what we have to prove then, usually, is that the person, when they made the promise, was unaware either how difficult it would be or of certain things that might come up. And if you can prove that, then you can, so to speak, retroactively annul the vow, right? So you see, it's more technical. But over here, we're talking about literally overriding her promise. So she was sincere. She understood what it involves. She really wants to do it. But the father can, only that day that he hears about it, say no, and then she doesn't keep it. That's not... She's not responsible to keep that promise. Now, the next part is even less PC, as we want to say, is the husband. Okay, so now, there is a concept, the psukim do go, the same, it seems to repeat, but goes to very interesting two stages in marriage. You know, in Torah we have two stages. One is called the engagement period, which is more than what we call an engagement. There's actually a whole signing of a document, and there's a real official commitment, and there's even an exchanging of the ring. So it's more that we would call... partially married, but not, they're not living together yet. There was, in the olden times, that's how they used to do it. They would have this like real commitment, and then the girl would be getting ready, you know, sewing all the bedding and all the clothing and whatever, getting ready for her wedding, and then they would come together, have a chuppah, and actually live together. So, interestingly enough, the middle stage, where she's what we might refer to as engaged, that stage, fascinatingly, both her father and the chosin have to annul the vow together. So if one says that she doesn't have to keep it and not the other, then she still has to keep it. It's very interesting. So that's the middle stage. But then we come to the third stage when she's fully married. Over there, the husband does have jurisdiction, it says, in two cases. If it's something that's going to harm her, so if she says something that's actually going to cause damage to herself, or if it's in the realm of something that affects him as well. So like, you can think of any example, but like if a woman says, I don't want to give that example, people will laugh, but I don't know, like I'm not doing any laundry, so you know, it might affect him. So he can say, no, I don't let her make this vow, and this vow is overridden. Okay, what? So if it's something, but if it's something not to do with him, he's not allowed to. The husband has no jurisdiction if it has nothing to do with him. In other words, if a woman says, I'm going to volunteer to do such and such, or I'm not going to say this, or I'm not going to talk about whatever it may be, she's allowed to do that. That's her own decision. But if it does affect him, he's permitted. Okay, now, again, this is if they're married. If somebody's not married, then no man can say whatever. Whatever a man wants to say, he can say, but she's still... she's bound by her words, and she's permitted to make whatever promise she is. And again, just to qualify, it's only on the day that he hears it that she makes the promise. After that, too bad. Even if it affects him, too bad. He just has to stand back and let her keep her promise, so to speak. Okay, it's very technical, these halachas, but...
Yom Kippur doesn't wipe it out?
Doesn't wipe it out, when we say Kol Nidre, right? Yes. Okay, so the truth is like this. Yom Kippur doesn't wipe it out... What Yom Kippur does is, if we've made a promise and we didn't keep it, then we get atonement for that. That's the idea. That's what Kol Nidre is. Like all the promise that we made that we didn't manage to keep. But it doesn't automatically annul our vows. No, we don't automatically annul. We should go, nowadays it's a little bit harder, but I must tell you that people still do it nowadays. If a person takes a vow upon themselves, and a vow means... For example, a very interesting thing, if a person, even if they didn't say it, but they started to do something, like they accustomed themselves to doing something, I don't know what it might be, but like a certain, I don't want to give an example that's not right, because I'm not a rabbi, but if you do something, like if you take upon yourself a certain stringency, even in kashrus, let's say, that you officially take upon yourself, and you do it a lot, then if you want to go back on it, you actually have to go and annul the vow. It's considered, you go in front of three men and you say, it's too much for me, I can't keep the stringency anymore. And they say, okay, you don't have to. And then it's annulled. So you actually have to actively annul it. I once had such a fad, this is such a fascinating thing, that I didn't think of that as a vow, but it comes in the same category, where one time I was making challah on Friday, and the challah that I separated, the piece of dough that I separated, became mixed back in to the regular dough. And so I didn't know which one is the challah dough. Now, it's interesting it's considered a vow because it means I've designated that as something holy, right? Although now we burn it, but nevertheless, it's designated. And now I don't know which part is designated. So what am I going to do? So it was the strangest thing. We called a few neighbors. I had to have three men, and I had to annul, because I made a bracha on that challah. And I had to sort of retroactively annul the vow of the taking of the challah and say, no, I didn't. And then I took challah again. It was such an interesting thing. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able. I know it was so strange. But it was a fascinating thing that, again, we don't realize the power of our words and our deeds, so to speak, and what we even like designate, so to speak. But that was one case. But people do it. If, like I say, if they've taken something and now they feel they can't keep it anymore. So you can do that. There is that process that you're allowed to do to annul your vows. But I want to just go back to the first Rashi, and I want to show you something, a very beautiful lesson before we finish this beautiful idea. Oh, sorry. No, don't go back to the first Rashi. I want to read the last pasuk. I want to show you something very interesting. So we're going to skip pages, just because it goes through all the different categories that we've just mentioned. And I'll tell you where I'd like to go to.
You see, it says 11 years in one day.
Yeah, that's, you see, it's interesting. From 11, I think, to like 12 and a half or something is the... Okay, if you go to page 377, do you see that we'll see the last two psukim of the chapter, page on page 377. It says v'im hofer yofer oisam.
What
does that mean? Skip all the way to page 377.
377.
Dina,
I have my Chumash.
Yeah. Oh. Okay, so I'll tell you what it is. Okay, good. So it's chapter 30 in Chumash Bamidbar, and we're going to 16, verse 16.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Tezayin. So he says, V'im hofer yofer oisam acharei shamay v'nosa es avayna. But if he shall nullify them after his having heard, he shall bear her iniquity. So in other words, if he says, you know, as we say, after meaning to say, as the time passed, and then he thinks he can nullify it, no, he's doing something wrong. Okay, but let's conclude. I want to show you the last pasuk. How does the chapter conclude and summarize? It says like this. Eile hachukim. These are the chukim, the decrees. Asher tziva Hashem es Moshe, that Hashem commanded Moshe, bein ish li ishtai, between a man and his wife, bein ov le bitai, between a man, a father and his daughter, binu ureha, in her youth, beis avia, in her father's house. Now, interesting word that's used here. Do you see what kind of category of mitzvah is he saying that this is? Do you see? It is a chayk, chukim. Do you remember the famous thing that there are three kinds of mitzvahs? Some mitzvahs we call mishpatim, they're the ones we understand. Like not to kill, not to steal, not to, I don't know, all the normal day-to-day things that we do, the ethical, moral laws. There's mitzvahs that we call edus, testimonies, like keeping Shabbos. It testifies, Hashem created the world in 6 days, we rest on the seventh, we eat matzah on Pesach, because we testified to the fact that Hashem took us out of Egypt. Those are the testimonies. So they have logical ideas, but they're only done because we know the story. Then there's the third category. Third category, chukim. What are chukim? Chukim are the ones that we don't understand. The famous example, like shatness, you know, not having wool and linen, the paraduma, the red heifer, right? All that. Very interesting. He is calling this category of law chukim. When we're talking about keeping our word, which category would you think it fits into? That a person has to be careful with what they say, not only careful with what they say, but once they've said it, either Eidus or Mishpatim, right? I mean, like, I think it's considered, you know, a normal moral ethical thing by everybody, anybody in the world, right? They keep their word. That's what a moral person does. So anybody, it doesn't matter where you come from, right, in the world, and what, you know. So it's interesting how he's describing this as chukim. fascinating thing. And the Chachamim actually discuss what is a chayk about this, and which part is he, I sort of speak, separating to be called chukim. And I want to show you something now. So to understand that, let's go back to the first Rashi. I want to show you something interesting. See, all the way now, go back to verse 1, Pasuk Aleph of this same chapter, and I'm going to see the Rashi, because I'm going to show you what Rashi says here. It's important to give us the whole context. I'll show you a nice lesson. Okay, so he says, Rashi Amatis. Because we started off with the question, as Rona said, she thinks it was taka to the heads. Who is Moshe Rabbeinu speaking to? So he says, the Pasuk says, the heads of the tribes. So he says, Chalak kavag l'nesiim, he accorded honor to the princes, l'lamdam, to teach them. What does Rashi say? Techila, first. So does it mean he only teaches the princes? No. He teaches it to everybody. But who does he teach first? He teaches the heads of the tribes. And we'll see in a minute why. Then he says, V'achar kach, and only afterwards, L'chol b'nei Yisrael, did he teach all the rest of the children of Israel. Minayin, and from where do we know, Sha'af shar ha-dibreis kain, that the truth is that the whole Torah was taught in this manner. Talmud Leimar, the Torah teaches us, V'yashuvu eilav arein v'chol ha-nasiyim ba'eda, and Aaron and all the princes of the assembly returned to him, which means they returned to Moshe. And Vayidaber Moshe Aleihem, and Moshe would speak to them. And after he would speak to Aaron, and actually there was a very specific order, he would first teach it to Aaron. Then Aaron's sons would come in, and he would say it again to Aaron and his sons. Then the heads of all the tribes would come in, and Moshe would repeat it to Aaron, his sons, and the heads of the tribes. And then Moshe would say it to the entire Jewish nation. We say this is how it worked for everything. It says, V'achareichein nikshu kol b'nei Yisrael. And after that, all the children of Israel would approach. So the question is, if that's the case, if it's done by all the mitzvahs, why are we specifically teaching it by this mitzvah? You understand? It's interesting, because by other mitzvahs, we don't see it. By other mitzvahs, it just says, Moshe spoke to the entire Jewish people. But we know that even by those mitzvahs, he first taught it to Aaron and to the leaders, and only then to the rest of the Jewish people. But here, he's teaching that this is really the procedure. Why here? So he says an interesting thing. Because he says, Shahafaras nidarim, the nullification of vows, can be performed b'yachid mumche, by an individual who is an expert. V'im ein yachid, which means one person can actually nullify a vow, but he has to be an expert, which we don't have nowadays. So if you don't have that, then what do? B'shloisha hadyaitis, then you can use three common people. They can come together and they can nullify a vow. And then he goes into a whole interesting thing. Maybe we can say the other way. Maybe this was only said to the princes. So Rashi doesn't. Rashi says, no, it's not possible to say this was only said to the princes. And he brings a certain way of learning, which is, it's a technicality. It's called a gzeira shava. When you have the same words of a pasuk used in two places, then we learn that they are similar delivery. In other words, if the same words are used, it means that we can apply that something similar happened. What is so? He gives an example that over here we use the words ezeh hadavar, this is the matter. There's another place that we use the same words when it talks about bringing sacrifices outside of the Beis HaMikdash. And there it also uses the word zeh hadavar. And we know that that was told to the entire Jewish people. So we say here also. I know it's a technicality, but it's the way we learn. It's one of the ways that the Torah is expounded upon. Okay, it doesn't matter. It's not such an important thing. But what I want to stress here is that according to Rashi, Rashi seems to say that these halachas were taught definitely, for sure, to the entire Jewish people. Just that it was first taught to the heads. Rashi is one opinion. There are other opinions, and I'm not going to go inside, even though I made you a copy, I'll share with you such an interesting thing. The Ramban and many other opinions say, no. These halachas were taught to the heads of the tribes, and in a way which was actually almost quite secretive. Why? Because if you think about it, what are we saying here? We're saying that if you've taken upon yourself a vow, you know, there's a way out. You can annul the vow if you want to. And the Ramban says that Hashem is worried that if people are aware of this, well, then they won't treat their words with the respect that it deserves, because they think, oh, I can take a vow and then I can annul it, right? So that's why this is really something that we have to, not secret, but it's not something that should be so public, because most people don't have the discipline to treat their words with the proper respect. So teach it to the ones who need to know, because in certain cases, people will need to annul the vows. But don't make it such a public thing, so that people should, rather the other way around, what should the leaders of the people be doing? More emphasizing how careful you have to be with your words, not teaching them how to annul their vows. So you see, it's a very interesting thing. This seems to be the view, actually, of many of the early commentaries, except for Rashi. Now, he's not the only one, but Rashi, so why does Rashi differ? Very interesting thing. Rashi differs because Rashi shows us something interesting. If you look into the psukim, what are most of the psukim dealing with? Is it dealing with the taking of the vows, or is it dealing with the annulment of the vows? When you look into the psukim, the annulment of the vows, right? The taking of the vow is only in one pasuk, but the most of the psukim in this chapter was dealing with how to annul those vows, or who can annul those vows, so to speak. So Rashi says, according to the simple interpretation, we can't say, it's a very interesting thing, the word that, and also Rashi says, at the end, how do we categorize this? As a chayik. What's a chayik? A chayik is a mitzvah that we don't really 100% understand. Because he says, if you think about it, annulling vows is a chayik. The taking of the vow is not a chayik, right? In other words, and the keeping of it. That's the mishpat. But to annul it, to have the power to retroactively go back on what you've said, that's only the Torah, in a sense, can allow such a thing. You know, can give such power, such jurisdiction, that we have the ability to say, maybe I didn't mean what I said, right? To go back almost, it's almost like the concept of tshuva, you know, going back in time kind of thing. And that is much more of a chayk than it is of a mishpat. And that's why Rashi says an interesting thing. This is really being taught to everybody. Why? Now we come to another step. And it's such a fascinating, beautiful thing. Because remember we started with the whole moral idea. What's the best way to live? Is it ideal that we take upon ourselves vows, and we're talking specifically about vows, let's say, that we say, I'm not permitted, let's say I'm not going to eat this and this, right? I'm not going to eat this and this for the next year. What's the best way to say I'm not going to eat such a thing? Or is it better to say I will eat it in the proper way? What's the ideal? I know, we would love to. I know, we wish we had that discipline. Obviously, the ideal is, as we said, because Hashem made the world for us to enjoy. And the ideal is that we should be able to engage in the material world, in the physical world, in the pleasures, in everything that we do and enjoy, right? We should. That's what Hashem wants. That we should be able to and not enjoy it and use it out in the right way. Use it, you know, to make us in a better mood. Use it to help somebody. Use it, whatever it may be, right? That's a good thing, to use the material. But we, when we're honest with ourselves, sometimes we know that if we're going to start engaging in that activity, we're not going to be able to discipline ourselves, and we won't have the proper parameter. So sometimes we do have to take upon ourselves and do a neder, so to speak. So here the Torah is teaching us something very, very, it's a very important, so to speak, if you want to say formula. It says like this, initially, it's sometimes we do have to take a neder. We have to make a vow, because that's the stage we're up to. We're not yet at the stage that we can be for sure that we'll be able to engage with it properly. However, what we must be aware of, and that's why we are all taught this halacha, not only the leaders, but every Jew, has to be aware that the goal ultimately is that we should try and improve ourselves and refine ourselves and elevate ourselves and sanctify ourselves to the point that we can engage with other things in a disciplined way. That's the goal. So why is it first taught to the leaders? Because the truth is, what gives us the strength to do that? How will we be able to grow and be able to engage with things in the proper way? if we have the guidance, if we have the inspiration of the leadership, which could be, a leader doesn't mean, if you understand, there's certain people that are leaders, but somebody who is in this area stronger than us, right? Somebody we look up to in this area. If we have that guidance, then we will be able to grow to the point that we can say, now we can annul the vow. Now we think we can engage healthfully in that activity. So you see how we have the double edge. So we need the leader, we need the inspiration, and yet we also need to know ourselves that this is the goal, that we have to, really the goal is to annul the vow. But sometimes we have to start with the vow. And that's not a bad thing. So it's a very fascinating thing, this balance that we have to have. And also why we need another person is because a lot of times we are very subjective in ourselves. We don't know. So we might think, it's no problem. You know, like some people will say, I can do such and such and it won't lead me to anything negative. It's okay. I'll control myself. But somebody who's a really close, you know, friend, like a really somebody who knows you, and will tell you, no, I don't think you're really up to that yet. I don't think it's such a good idea. Like, you know how it is sometimes, like, even sometimes we, like a silly example, but sometimes we might even, you know, think, should I be hanging out with these people? And the other person knows that whenever you go there, you get down. You know, they just schlep you down. You say, oh, no, I'm strong enough, I'll be fine. The other person says, no, I don't think it's a good idea yet. So you do have to have that ability to listen to another. That's what we're learning from here. And that person says, not yet. When you get stronger, you'll be able to. And then it's okay. That's fine. Now you strengthened yourself, and now you're up to engaging in it. And this is where we need to have the voice of another, and yet also our own ability to look and to see where we feel perhaps that we are in danger or a little bit, you know, in an area that we have to be a little bit more cautious. And this is really the real lesson from this whole chapter, is this idea. So it's a fascinating concept to do with speech as well as our how we engage with things in the world. And they all come through. This is what it teaches us. So just very interesting. Even though it's like, in a sense, halachas, as we say, there are so many technical halachas involved, but really it's a whole approach to how we live our life. That's really what it teaches us in a quite a beautiful way. Again, the power of our words, that communication, and our engaging with each other. And what's beautiful also, I think also a person should also realize, sometimes we have the responsibility, especially if it's somebody we care about, to yes, say something, to say maybe you should do this, or maybe you should stop, or maybe take a break from this for a little bit of time, whatever it may be, because you see that it's harming them. And that's also an important thing for us to realize, that sometimes we assume that position of what we call leadership in that friend's life, because you are able, you have the ability to help them make the right decisions. So it goes both ways in this. So yeah. Anyway, so we'll leave it over here. Just a fascinating.
You should have dignity.
100%.